Welcome to Insight on PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell. This is our first broadcast on PRN.FM, and introducing Liz Malone. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Mark.
What do you think of the new digs here?
Aside from the glass of water I just spilled, it's fantastic.
Boy, this table is actually gleaming because it's so clean because of that bottle of water I just spilled.
Hey, I'm just doing my part.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things we're going to be talking about today is overcoming adversity, and we just overcame a great giant spill, so things move on, right? Things happen, and we clean them up, and we move on. So a little bit about myself. I've been broadcasting in New York for a bunch of years as a talk show host, having lots of fun. And as you know, everyone knows, terrestrial radio has changed a great deal. And I had always wanted to take my life lessons. We all have a lot of them. And kind of share them. And you're going to learn a lot about my background and my experience and personal, professional hurdles and successes in today's show and forthcoming shows. So I became a speaker in the last 2 years and travel across the nation, speak to audiences young as kindergarten. And they are great listeners, by the way. You would never guess, Liz.
I would never in a million years guess that.
They ask some of the best questions. And they have endless questions. Teachers have to cut them off.
It's because they're so honest. They don't have the filters yet.
Absolutely. So, and also young adults, teenagers, college-age kids, professionals, corporate world. Yeah, the corporate world people. Yeah, they need some instruction, that's for sure.
Not as honest as the kindergartners.
No. So, Overcoming Adversity is one of the programs that's one of the more popular programs I present upon. And the reason why I came up with that title is because I was born with a permanent visual disability called retinoschisis. It's kind of like macular degeneration, which is very widespread in the world. And Liz has also, it's not because we're friends of this, it's just, and we didn't bond because of this, actually, but we did meet because of our visual impairments. Tell them a little bit about the name of your visual impairment, Liz.
My disease is called retinitis pigmentosa. And it's a degenerative disease of the retina. And the progression is slower than what you have, Mark. But definitely in the same family and, you know, every day waiting for a cure.
And if you're in the in crowd, it's called RP, yo.
Very in crowd. You're so hip with the eye disease, Mark.
So with my disease, it's hereditary. My mother was a carrier. It affects the male chromosome. There is no surgery as of yet, but the NIH, National Institute of Health, is telling me it's not if, it's when. And they're saying in the next few years, also the Foundation Fighting Blindness funds a lot of cutting-edge labs across the world. But I couldn't wear glasses or contact lenses, and again, there was no surgery. So growing up, it was very difficult, as Liz has a different experience because her onset wasn't until your mid-20s.
Well, that was when I was severely afflicted with the disease. It started when I was probably a preteen, you know, because night blindness is the first sign. And that's around that age when you start, like, hanging out in the park at night in New Jersey, you know, running from the cops. And I was the only one who couldn't run. I couldn't see.
That's funny. So it's interesting because we met in Central Park probably in, oh, geez, what year was this? 95? 92? Something like that.
Something like that.
I was actually volunteering for an organization called Achilles Track Club in New York City, founded by Dick Trom, a amputee, above-the-knee amputee. He was the first actual amputee to run the New York City Marathon 40 years ago or so, and I believe he still runs with the same wooden leg. Anyway, I was there volunteering for that stellar organization, and Liz was there volunteering and manning a table for a Foundation Fighting Blindness, and I bellied up to the table and asked her for a beer because I thought it was a bar, and she said, get the hell out of here, you freak.
He says he walked. I think it was more like strutted.
Yeah, I kind of
like it was a little strut.
John Wayne kind of gallop there. But anyway, that's how we met. It's kind of interesting because, you know, you were there representing a foundation that you obviously were very close to at the time. And that was my introduction to FFB, Foundation Fighting Blindness, which mm-hmm. is a great organization, as I mentioned. And we've been friends ever since. And it's been neat because we've been able to share some of our, sorry to say this word, but insight and experiences with our things we need accommodations for, things we can do, things we can't do.
Well, you know, sometimes people who are visually impaired or legally blind, they sometimes view the population as sighted and unsighted. And sometimes it takes somebody with a limitation to fully understand exactly what the world looks like to us and how it is to navigate through it.
And most importantly, give each other tips on technology. Oh, you can do what with your iPhone? Oh, you need to get this app and that app. Like, I'm using a timer. I have this on my iPad as well when I use it at lecture halls when I need to be, like, spot on or, like, yeah, 47 minutes. I'm like, okay, it's huge. And I hold it up to the crowd. I'm like, would you mind walking around with one of these? So going back to the overcoming adversity topic. So when I was in school, I was very challenged with reading blackboards. I mean, sitting in a front row with a drag. I mean, you know, I considered myself to be uncool for sitting in the front row. And here I was struggling to read a chalkboard, and of course it was very, very difficult. And reading books was very much a challenge, so I was always behind in school, which was a real bummer. And sports, you know. So of course the educational process scholastically, you know, did wonders for my confidence. And then introducing sports. So I wasn't very good because I wasn't able to see that many most sports that well. So I tried out for basketball, actually, about seventh grade, and I made it. I couldn't believe it. I made it. I was so happy. Ran home. Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. All my siblings. I was like, this is great. But I didn't last long because of two reasons. Number one, during basketball practice, I don't know how many guys are on a team. I guess like maybe 18 or 20. You figure there's that many basketballs flying around, and I could not keep track. I could not zone in on them. And that was a real drag because obviously you need to see a basketball coming your way. Hello. And then the other thing was I was a little bit husky. I love that word, husky. How do you define husky?
Big boned.
Big boned.
Big boned.
I'm not big boned, so I guess I was just a little fat. A little flabby, a little fat. So when you had to take off your shirt for skins against shirts, I was not feeling too comfortable. And it was before I had onset of really, really bad acne where I had to take two bouts of Accutane, which is a great medication. I recommend it to everybody. Not really. But anyway, so I wasn't too confident. I made up some excuse to the coach that I had to quit because I needed some money for blah, blah, blah. So that was the beginning of some awkwardness in terms of being introduced to sports. But interestingly enough, my mother, God bless her, you know, a single parent. My father was around the corner. That I grew up in a divorced household, three sisters, one brother. But my father was close. But she signed me up for Little League. I guess back then you didn't have to try out. That's why I was able to play. And the brilliant coach that I had back then stuck me in the outfield. I think, I block most of this all out, but I think it was right field because isn't that where most of the action is, right field? Or left field.
I think it's left because more batters are righty and
exactly.
They pull left.
Okay. So I was in, I'm not sure, whatever, field. It doesn't matter because I didn't do anything. So you'd hear crack. The ball would land, and I'd hear, to your right. No, behind you. In front of you, run up. And, I didn't know where the ball was, so I'd get the ball and I'd throw it. It was terrible. It was a bad scene. I didn't like going. And, of course, there was that one moment that we all have, like, one moment, like a sports moment or a time in school or socially that, you know, it's like your, 15 minutes in life that you have to shine. Well, here I was, tie score, bottom of the ninth, Mark Farrell's up at bat, two outs, full count, and here I am. My mother tells the story. She's like, oh, my God, I could hardly even look, Mark. So I'm thinking, oh, God, everyone in the dugout is just, like, packing up their stuff. The parents are exiting the stands, starting their car. And crack, I hit the ball. I couldn't believe I hit the ball. And I ran as hard as I could. I mean, I dug whatever sneakers I had, probably Converse back then, as fast as I could. And I slid into first base because that's what you're not supposed to do.
Absolutely.
I didn't know that you could overrun first base, and of course I was ridiculed about that. But I remember just being so glorified.
You were still in shock from hitting the ball.
That's it. That's it. And you you don't know how important that statement is because recently I had some friends over right before the holidays. A good friend of mine, Joe and Jen, and he said to me, Mark, I'm going to be playing some indoor softball. I'd never heard of indoor softball. Have you?
Can't say I have.
Yeah. So anyway, it's kind of like, your basic softball, but it's a little bit of a spongy ball. But the point is that I said to him, I was busting his chops, had a few cocktails in me. I'm like, hey, Joe, you didn't ask your good friend Mark if he wanted to play, meaning me. He's like, well, Mark, I didn't think he could see the ball. I'm like, well, you know what, Joe? I have this uncanny ability to actually place the ball where I think it could be. For example, a pitcher. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah. So I tell you what. can I try? He's like, yeah, come to a practice. I'm like, no, let's not even do the practicing. Let me just come over your house, not in front of any other, you know, players, and I'll throw you some balls. And if it works, it works. If not, nothing ventured, nothing gained. He's like, great. So we went over. I went over his house, and it's like a 15-degree day, perfect to, you know, play softball. I throw him some pitches. He's like, great. You can do it. I'm like, really? I'm like, wow, this is great. So the first game comes, and I was so completely nervous. Liz, I was so out of my element. Have you ever been, whatever, in a work environment, on a date, you just feel completely and utterly uncomfortable?
Butterflies.
Beyond that.
Really?
You just feel like you're out of your realm.
Wow.
It was a fake smile. Everything I put on, I actually had, I can't say blackouts, but I'll tell you a little bit more as the show progresses, but there were actually things I didn't remember until the next day because I was so nervous.
Wow. The adrenaline was pumping that hard.
Yeah. And so I was playing with a bunch of great guys, really good team. And, you know, I'm pitching and I was doing well. And I that should alleviate a lot of my, you know, anxiety or whatever was going on. And I actually had a ball, you know, line drive right at me. And I actually caught a piece of it. So it hit my cheek, but not as hard as it would have been. And I remember we were on the phone. I told you about this. And you're like, Mark, you're worried about two things. What were they, Liz?
Yeah, the jewels and the noggin.
Yeah,
or if
yeah.
you prefer the other order, the noggin and
yeah,
the jewels.
Well, you know, sometimes I think with one of them and not the other, or both, or vice versa. You know my point. Anyway, so it was going really well, and I was psyched. But it was funny because the next day I actually called my friend Joe. I'm like, Joe, did I catch a ball and then throw somebody out at second? He's like, yeah. I'm like, I just remembered that. I mean, there were things actually, however you want to term this, I imagine there's a psychological phenomenon or term about this, but things were coming back slowly because I was so uncomfortable, out of my element.
Well, I'm just so happy every time I see you and you don't have a black eye and you don't smile like a jack-o'-lantern.
Well, you know what? My point is that I try anything. And that's one of the reasons why overcoming adversity is such an interesting talking point and component in everyone's life. For yourself as well, I mean, you're being faced with a new form of adversity that your vision is decreasing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your life is different than it was 5 years ago. And a lot of our lives are different. You know, maybe we're in a different relationship, a marriage, a job. Maybe we don't have a home that we lived in 5 years ago because we don't have a job. We don't have the financial stability. We're not solvent. You know, there's so many different aspects of being aspects of adversity. You're ill. You know, it's not just financial. It could be mental health. And we have a lot of topics we're going to be getting to. But, you know, that's one of the things that I'd like to put out there to people is that, you know what, there are a lot of things I can't do, but there's a lot of things I can do because I just try.
Have you been following the story of the young man from Rhode Island, Isaac Lufkin?
Yes.
Isn't he incredible?
He is incredible.
Oh.
That's a heartwarming story.
It's fantastic. I mean, watching him when he was at the Super Bowl, and just to give a little bit of backstory real quick in case if anyone doesn't know who he is. If you don't know who Isaac is, Isaac Lufkin, I suggest that you Google him and read his stories.
How do you spell his last name? Because I couldn't do it justice.
It's Lufkin.
Lufkin.
Yes. And he's from Rhode Island. I think he's 14 years old. And he was born without arms. And regardless of the disability that he's facing, he is the star kicker on his freshman football team.
It's phenomenal.
And so the NFL caught wind of him, flew him along down with his mom to the Super Bowl, gave him VIP treatment, shaking hands with everyone from Clinton to Kevin Costner. And he has these aspirations to be in the Super Bowl one day. He wants to play for the Ravens.
And he brought out the ball.
Did he?
He brought out the game ball. I believe that was him.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'll take your word for it.
That's who I thought it was. The announcers actually didn't do it justice enough because there was a lot going on. Obviously, you know, it's the moment before Joe Namath has to be shown wearing his fur coat. And it's more impossible.
I think his coat peed on the field.
You know, Joe. That's all you can say about Joe. So anyway, adversity is rampant. Everybody has different forms of whether it's real or perceived, whether it's cognitive or physical, or whatever it is in your life. As a matter of fact, when I was in school, when I wasn't able to do well academically and or in sports, I learned to actually find my way around the woodshop very well because being my mother's single parent, my father not around, I became sort of the man of the house and did a lot of the repairs. So I was very interested in wood shop and became very good. As a matter of fact, my senior year, I think I had 3 classes of cabinet making. So long story short, Pat Redding was one of my great teachers early on, but one of my later teachers, I just forgot his name. Brum, I forget his last name, first name. But he said to me in the class simultaneously, and I almost, my jaw almost hit the floor. He's like, if anyone needs any woodcut on the table saw is the most dangerous tool in the whole cabinet making shop. It's where a blade that's 10 inches wide comes up probably about 5 to 7 inches wide, high off the table if you needed to. So you could easily lose digits, a forearm, whatever. He said, you come to see me or you see Mark. I'm like, are you kidding me? You're putting me up there with you? And so I realized that, wow, this is really neat that, you know, here I am not able to see a lot of things, but I'm very, very, very careful, and I have a lot of respect. People say to me, well, how can you use a tool so dangerous? Because I respect the blade. You know, it's like, hello, blade. Like, what's that movie? Adjust the Ball, Ralph Crandom. Hello, ball. But I respected the blade, and you have to. So there's a lot of things I just don't, you know, because I'm visually impaired, I don't allow it to hinder my life. And if I can't do it, I can't do it, but I try it. Right, Liz?
Absolutely.
Is there anything that kind of prevented you or after your onset that you had your eyes on or dreamed of doing that you either have done or are still contemplating doing it?
Well, I've had things unfortunately taken away. The one thing I miss probably more than anything, I miss driving.
Yeah.
I used to love to drive. Loved it. Driving down the New England Turnpike. Going 95, getting pulled over by a state trooper and crying my way out of a ticket.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Our engineer actually is going to play a promo for us that kind of depicts a little bit of the show. And we're going to play the first few seconds of it because I want everyone to get a flavor of a little bit of more types of adversity. Let's hear that promo, please. Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course?
All well, right, thanks, Melissa. And I've
got some so the last one is about a triathlon, unable to see a swim course during a triathlon. So when I was in college back in 88, I did my first triathlon. I figured, you know, I'm good at cycling because I never got off a bike. Even when I was in high school, you know, I rode everywhere on a bike. Everyone was turning 17, getting their license. I mean, that's a paramount day in anyone's life, you know. It's freedom, the ultimate in freedom. You get your driver's license, and I knew I wasn't going to get a driver's license because of my visual disability. And I was as cool as I could have been. You know, that day I just got a regular Tom Carvel ice cream cake, and that's pretty damn good in my book. And all these years later, I still Jones for a Tom Carvel cake. Anyway.
Cookie puss.
Exactly, cookie puss, yeah. Tom Carvel. Anyway, poor guy. So that day came and went, so I always had been on a bicycle. So triathlon, the world of triathlon was developed, you know, mid to late 80s, and I kind of jumped on a bandwagon early, and I figured, okay, I could do the bike, no problem, because I can only see like 10 feet ahead of me, 15 feet away, when people usually look further down the road, but I can see a twig, a pothole, et cetera, and I'm very careful, and I really know how to really handle and manipulate a bike very well. Swimming, no problem, you know, I'll be able to train, and running, yeah, I can do running, no problem. Okay, so the big day came and went. And I tell this is a 25-minute story. I call it Leap of Blind Faith when I do a program live for audiences. And I can be, you know, I can target it towards fifth graders, high schoolers, college age audiences, or corporate, and give parallels to the examples and to all the hurdles I had to overcome during that one race. So the biggest point of the story is I get to the swim course. This is the first part of the triathlon, 3 legs, swim, bike, run, yes, all in one day, simultaneously.
I'm getting tired just hearing about
it. Exactly, even just talking about it. So I get to the swim course. I am so stoked. I jump in the water. It was like bath water. It was unbelievable. I felt this is great. This is dynamite. My first triathlon. This is so cool. I trained hard. My parents, who were divorced for years, who my father did not talk to my mother, actually came in the same car. That spoke volumes about the day ahead of me. I'm like, this is what brought you guys together? This is what it took? I would have done this years ago. So anyway, the race is about to go off. I get out of the water and put my goggles on. I introduce myself to the guy next to me. I'm like, hey, my name's Mark. This is my first triathlon. He's like, hey, my name's blah, blah, blah. And I said to him, hey, when do you think they're going to put out the race course buoys? He's like, it's right there. And I'm like, right there. He points straight ahead. I'm like, oh. It never dawned on me. I couldn't see the race course.
Those famous last words, they're right there.
They're right there.
I hear them. They're right there.
They're right there. For you, they're right there. Not for me.
Where?
So at that moment, Liz, and to PRN listeners, I was in a complete conundrum. What am I going to do? I never thought about this. How could I have not considered the swim course? I mean, this is new to me, but it's an example of not considering myself disabled or limited. So, I dug my toes into the sand. I leaned over, and my mother and father were behind me. My girlfriend at the time was there, and I'm thinking, like, well, they're not going to think less of me if I bow out. I mean, this is life or death. I mean, there's, you know, back then there was hundreds of people thrashing in the water. I mean, this is dangerous. So, I mean, it could easily back out. So I went with it. I did it. And that was many, many moons ago and many triathlons ago. And to this day, it's funny, I'll go to the swimming line in the sand and people will be like, wow, man, we had to swim all the way out there and then make a left and go around that buoy and then come over here. And I'm laughing like, dude, I'm saying this to myself. I can't see and I'm not sweating. I'm just following everybody. And guess what? I go off course all the time, but resiliency rules and I don't give up. And I've done multiple triathlons since and I've yet to see a swim course. What do you say about that, Liz? You're completely speechless?
You're looking at somebody who is at a very unathletic stage of their life. So, honestly, I'm just in such awe.
But you were a tomboy when you were growing up.
Yeah, that means I was tough. It doesn't mean I was athletic. I didn't say I was good at it.
I thought you were good, though. I thought you were athletic.
Actually, I was when I was young.
What was your sport of choice?
Baseball when I was really young. And then as I got older, it was gymnastics.
That's a great sport.
I was a gymnast. Yes.
I have total respect for gymnasts.
So dangerous. I quit because of an injury.
On what apparatus or what?
Training and doing rotation in the air. Doing a 1.5, landed on the back of my neck.
On the uneven bars?
No. It was on the training on using a trampoline.
Oh, trampoline.
Practicing the rotation in the air.
Now you just have one in your bedroom.
Well, you know, I don't know.
So that's overcoming adversity. And in the beginning of that promo that Melissa kindly played for us a few moments ago, I speak about in the tease of the promo, you know, have you ever ridden on top of an elevator? And the reason why I say that is because I actually did that when I was in college. I'm sure everyone listening has done that because everyone should ride on top of an elevator. Why should you ride inside a well-functioning elevator? It's like an airplane. Why should you ride inside of it when you can parachute, right? People say, why do you jump out of a well-functioning airplane? Anyway, so the reason why is because drugs and alcohol played a major part of my life when I was in college. You know, I thought this was a great new beginning for me. All these people, thousands and thousands of people, don't know who I am. They don't know I'm visually impaired. They don't know I'm not good academically. All these things, this is a brand new start. So I can be the big guy on campus, the big party guy, Joe College. How could I not have people adorning me, being the life of the party? Right?
You had a little more fun in college than I did.
Well, I survived, thankfully. So one night I came home from a frat party. I didn't go to too many of those because I wasn't a kind of frat kind of guy, even though I kind of sound like it, I'm sure, with all the debaucherous activities I was involved in. So I came home in an elevator full of people, my friends, and I don't know what took over me, but I just popped the hatch of the elevator out, shimmied up to the top of the elevator, myself and my dear friend Harry Blanding. Jumped up to the top, and we rode up and down. So that's pretty insane.
Risky.
But that wasn't insane or risky enough. When we were at the top floor, there's a skylight. I guess maybe an emergency hatch or a skylight for light to come in. And there's bars. So I said, oh, it would be even cooler if I hung from the bars. It would be the ultimate if I put my feet up in the bars, turn them, and hung upside down. That would be really neat. And that's what I did. Insane.
Does your mother know this? Or is she finding out right now for the first time?
You know, I'm not sure if she knows that particular story. She does know the story of undercover state troopers closing the campus down and ransacking my apartment that I share with three other guys. And the state troopers walked in with shotguns and they walked out with a giant frozen Ziploc bag of cocaine.
Just a typical Friday night.
Yeah, you know, actually it wasn't even a Friday. I think it was a Wednesday or a Thursday. So yeah, I have some experience with drugs and alcohol. Drugs, you know, I use rampantly, and they were rampant in college, and I used a lot of cocaine. Thankfully, I wasn't addicted. Alcohol is another story. It runs in my family. I'm predisposed to alcoholism. I thought that I was never, you know, going to be addicted to it, and I got to that precipice. Growing up, I used to go to AA meetings with my father and set up the chairs and help him make coffee, and that actually prompted him to get sober, because obviously, you know, if you have a child and kid helping you in such an important aspect of your life to be clean and sober, it worked. So I was very exposed and knew all the sad stories and went through Al-Anon and all that jazz. And once in a while, I'd actually go to an AA meeting and introduce myself and say, I'm not an alcoholic. And they'd all look at me like, you know, they're ready to jump down your throat. But I'm like, but this is why I'm here. I can be an alcoholic. And if I keep going at this rate, I will be an alcoholic. And I'll be in this chair right next to you, in this uncomfortable metal chair. But I won't be smoking two packs of cigarettes like you guys. But anyway, you know, so that's another thing I speak about to audiences, because drugs and alcohol, of course, are so rampant. And, of course, with the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman recently, it's just so sad that it happens. I mean, young, old. It's ubiquitous.
Well, he was certainly way too young to leave this earth. And he was such a, from what I hear, such an amazing person, such an amazing talent, which we all witnessed. But what's so sad about the whole drugs and alcohol phenomenon that's sort of had a resurgence in the last, maybe even in the last 2 years that you're hearing about it all
case
the time.
Case in point, heroin.
Yeah. Is that the people are getting younger and younger who are now, you know, abusing it. Case in point, my heart breaks every time I hear about that story, Ethan Couch, out in Texas.
Shame.
The teenager who killed 4 people. I mean, and to get off, or with, I should say, get off with only probation, thanks to something called affluenza.
Affluenza, baby. Hard to imagine.
I know. What about all the people that had poverty-itis?
It's a crazy world. Fortunately, I was invited to speak at a New Jersey school this past spring, and they have about a collective, I think, 2,500 kids in their school, freshmen through a senior year. So 4 grades. It's a large school.
2,500?
2,500.
That's pretty big.
And they have 50 attempts, actually, on their life. And a few successes, which is a terrible word to say, success, but, you know, kids actually were successful. So I was invited there to speak about mental health and drugs and mental health and overcoming adversity. These are all intertwined. And I was very happy to be invited, and but I was not happy when I got there, because when I realized school was out and I'm speaking to about 200 or 300 people that were parents in the middle of the day. So as excited as I was to be invited there and to share my experiences with mental health, I lost a brother to suicide back in 92. Then I experienced depression, anxiety, panic attacks, all that fun stuff. And so I have a lot of experience. As, again, you'll find out, because as the program goes on, you're finding out more and more layers, like I'm explaining all this fun stuff about me. But you know what? I really wouldn't change many of them, except for, of course, loss of my brother and a few other important, significant things in my life. But I was sad to report that when I got there, again, I was speaking to mostly parents, and people said to me, you know, after my 40 minutes of speaking, 45 minutes as a keynoter, they opened up the floor for questions, and they applauded me for being so honest and forthcoming. And that's what I think is the main ingredient of me being successful, is because I put it all out there. You have to be real, forthcoming, reveal who you are, be vulnerable, and other people will understand that, be susceptible, be open, and understand that, you know, you're not there and shucking and jiving. You know, I walk in, they think, oh, here's a guy who looks like, you know, Joe Normal. And then 5, 10, 15 minutes later, and they're into it, they're like, whoa, this guy's far from Joe Normal. But they have respect for me because I was able to overcome all these different aspects in life. You know, a lot of hard work. You know, it's not that like I didn't fall down and, you know, a few times here and there, metaphorically. But, you know, that's what I did. So I was asked that, you know, how can we prevent more suicides and or more suicide attempts? And again, I'm not a doctor. I even say this in a promo that Melissa actually cut off. I asked her to cut off moments before that part aired. I'm not a doctor. I'm just an expert in me. We're all experts in who we are. But I said, and I kind of paused in my mind because I really wanted to say, well, this conference should have been held when school was still in session. Students should be here. I should be speaking to maybe two or three sessions of kids, 300, 400, 500, 800 kids a clip. But I'm saying to myself, do I want to cut off my notes despite my face? Because, you know, I may not be invited back. They're filming this. They're going to play it on a local cable channel, et cetera. So, you know, I kind of walked around the issue as well as I could without kind of offending the Board of Ed, who was present in the room. But I said, you know, students really need to be immersed in the reality of what's going on. This is an epidemic. This isn't, it's not going to happen to my kid. 2,500 kids, 50 attempts a year. This is real. So I thought it was very effective. The parents thought it was very effective. And that's all we can do nowadays. I mean, we put it out there.
And I bet you now you're going to get invited back.
I hope so. I hope so. On the flip side of this, we're going to talk more about mental health and learn about, obviously, how prevalent suicide, anxiety, and more of mental health issues exist on PRN.FM.
So I was back in high school, and we were in biology class. We're learning about dissecting frogs. And I think to myself, hey, I'm a journalist. Why can't I dissect the news? And so I started doing it. And I have the newsdissector.net blog, and I have News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Join me here. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Love, lust, and laughter. Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
Hello, listeners. I'm your host, Patricia Shepherd, for Idle No More Indigenous Report, reporting and discussing current issues and challenges facing federally recognized tribes here in the United States and the First Nations in Canada. You will hear issues surrounding fishing, hunting, and gathering rights, environmental threats to land, water, and air, and we will listen and discuss music, language, and traditions. You can listen to Idle No More Indigenous Report on Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. If you'd like to listen to Idle No More Indigenous Report live, you can listen 24/7 on the archive at PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
All right, it's Insight on PRN.FM. I'm Mark Farrell, the Liz Malone. Well, we are actually recording a few hours before the major, major storm is coming into wreak havoc on the Big Apple here in New York City. Broadcasting on the Upper West Side, it is PRN.FM. We're doing this. Unfortunately, we want to be live. We are going to be live every Thursday from 11 to 12, right before the Gary Null Show with Gary Null. But we didn't think we'd be able to get into the studio and or maybe many of the employees of PRN, the fine folks here, the engineers, programmers, et cetera, because we're supposed to be hit with another, what is this, the fourth major storm we're getting? It's crazy.
I'm starting to lose track.
I'm starting to actually love and appreciate the snowblower that I had no interest in buying about a month and a half ago.
But, I will never make fun of people moving to Florida ever again.
Sign me up. It's unbelievable. So hopefully wherever you are, it's sunny, balmy, comfortable, and open another one and have a drink for us, for Liz and I. Right? Let's
please.
Yeah, exactly.
As I sip my hot tea.
So what are you doing in June, mid-June? Liz, do you want to walk about 26 miles? Well, you think about that. What about you, PRN listeners in the Philly, Philadelphia region, or in Seattle? The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is having their Out of the Darkness overnight walk. And now, if you haven't heard of these walks, they're very, very cool. They're very symbolic. It's called Out of the Darkness overnight walk because you start in the evening around 6-ish at night, and you walk at least 16 to 22, 24 miles, depending on the location, whether it's Philadelphia this year in June or in Seattle also in June this year. And it's to obviously bring awareness to suicide and all the mental health issues and the stigmas, et cetera. Of course, it's a fundraiser, and it's a very, very effective fundraiser. I actually have been recording the commercials, the radio commercials for American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for, I think, 10, 11 years now. And the way I got involved with this organization, as you know, Liz, my brother took his life in 1992, Mike Farrell, my oldest brother and only brother. And it was very unfortunate, extremely sad. And he had a lot to lose, and we miss him dearly. But that's how we got catapulted into this wonderful world of mental health. I didn't know much about it back then, you know, biology classes, psychology classes in college. And that's about as much as I knew. But right away, we found out about AFSP. And we kind of ingratiated ourselves with them and went to meetings. And my mother became, a few years into it, the chairman of the board of New Jersey chapter. And my sister is on the board of the national. And so we all do our part. And you can do your part. You can walk. And it's a lot of fun. I did the first walk, Liz, I told you, back in 02 in Washington, D.C. It started somewhere in Washington. I don't remember. Well, actually, it started in Maryland. And it finished at the Washington Monument.
Like I said, I'm going to be walking with you in spirit.
Well, we have a lot of time between now and then for me to coax you.
I have to start training now.
And get your little gymnast behind and some good sneakers, and you can walk. So anyway, you walk through the night, you walk, and you meet some terrific people, and you share your stories. You know, some people lost people. Some people are there because they're friends of people who lost relatives, siblings, parents, coworkers, boyfriend, wife, spouse, whatever the case may be. But it's a real bonding event, and it's really symbolic, again, out of the darkness. So you from dawn to dusk, or dusk to dawn, and then you're walking to the Washington Monument. Oh, P.S., by the way, I was in the first part of the group, and they had misplaced the signs, so we ended up walking over 26 miles, like about 2 or 3 miles longer.
You overshot the landing.
But it's for charity, right? It's for a great cause. So, yeah, we were so fatigued and tired. We're like, okay, we'll turn around. It was like, I guess, like 50 of us. So we turned around anyway. We get back to the Washington Monument, and it was just so glorious. I'm not like a guy who tears up pretty easily, but I got there, and I was like all welled up because the sun's coming up, the Washington Monument. They're playing this very euphoric music, and, you know, you spend all this time, you know, walking with people, and it's just very, very bonding, and synergy was just palpable.
And then you all go for breakfast.
Actually, I think I went to the hotel, packed my clothes, didn't fall asleep until I got in the back of someone's car and just sacked out until I got back to New Jersey. But what an incredible event.
Oh, it sounds it.
Yeah. If you're interested in finding out more information, go to outofthedarknessovernight.org, outofthedarknessovernight.org, and you can sign up and or have somebody sponsor you. Or if you ever want to volunteer, I mean, things of this nature are just great. And again, I wasn't, and my family, wasn't familiar with any issues so severe, certainly as suicide. But years after my brother had died, I had a bout of depression. And with depression, unfortunately, scientists don't know why. I mean, so much of the brain, scientists don't understand the functionality of it. But you have suicidal thoughts. And I had these suicidal thoughts, like serious ones. I'm standing on a platform in Times Square thinking like, oh, I'm going to leap in front of this train. But I knew I wasn't going to do it. But the brain, the chemistry, the serotonin levels are just so off. You're off kilter. Everything, you know, it's just such a dark time. But it was so frightening. And that's one of the other programs I talk about, mental health, and how I overcame that, and how I was so afraid to go to my family. You know, this is a couple years after my brother died, and say to him, hey, listen, this is what I'm experiencing. I thought they're going to freak out and be like, okay, let's get him to the hospital. Nothing's going to happen to Mark. And they were pretty cool, calm, and collected about it. They were like, okay, you know, have you been taking any new vitamins? They were just trying to think if it's, you know, anything related to, but, you know, it's just simply plain anxiety, which led into depression, which led into suicidal thoughts. And thankfully, you know, I had some very good therapists and a not-so-good therapist. And I think you have a story of dealing with somebody who was less than professional.
I think, but you know, you just, if I could just rewind, you touched upon something.
Please do.
That feeling of anticipation of sharing your story can be so paralyzing. And you always picture it being so much worse than it really is. You're imagining how your family is going to react. And it's that first moment where you reach out to somebody and you tell them exactly what is going on inside of you. That's
absolutely
the hardest
true.
Part.
But isn't that true for most things in life? I mean, the anxiety of an act is much greater than the anticipation than the actual event itself.
I guess it's, you know, and I maybe it's just human nature that we just build it up much. And that's always, I don't know how, I mean, I think we need to just, I need to tell you first so you can smack me and then I can smack you back.
Well, this is a great example, okay? That's a major example we're talking about. Here's a minor example, but it has the same cause and effect. My office, I like collect papers and bills and stuff, you know, like we do monthly, and I let it pile up 8, 10, 12, 14 months. I'm like, all right, I'm going to put this away. I got to file it. I got to go through the crap and throw it out, blah, blah, blah. And then when I finally get around to it, I'm like, that was nothing but the anticipation of actually doing something so, you know, menial was gargantuan, but it took nothing to do. All that wasted energy for nothing.
The stress.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, so many of us do that in life. I mean, I'm much better about it because I'll either do something or I'll be like, oh, well, you know what? I'm sure the anticipations are great, much greater than the actual event.
So do you think the first step is to recognize the fact that we are making this into a mountain out of a molehill?
Absolutely. And it's so hard to get people to realize that because, you know, recognition and acceptance of something, of course, is the biggest problem. Because, I mean, if you have an alcohol problem, a drug problem, a situation in a relationship, you know, whether it's abusive, you know, just realizing, you know what, this is not good for me. This is causing me harm, whether it's physical harm or cognitive harm. It's just not healthy for you. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think we just have to get out of running around in that circle that we can't share things with people, that people won't understand, and that everyone is going to judge us.
Well, share with me how many weeks it's been since you've had a ciggy.
5 weeks.
Whoa.
Thank you.
Nice work, Liz.
Thank you.
2014's your year, baby.
I'm trying.
That's great. How you doing? What's the worst aspect of quitting smoking?
Breaking the rituals.
Besides the nunchucks in front of you. I'm about to, like, take my head off if I do anything wrong. Biting your nails. I see you don't have any cuticles or nails.
Yeah, you know, that thing. And empty candy wrappers all over my home. Mm. That sort of thing.
How's your boyfriend dealing with this? Has he moved out? Is he still loving you?
He's
busy.
He's working a lot lately.
Yeah. You can't blame the guy, right? Oh, my God, that stuff. But, you know, it's just like anything else. And kudos to you, you know, first couple of weeks. I think it's 3 weeks to quit a habit. And that doesn't apply to smoking, I'm sure.
You know, I'm really not sure about that. I think that's probably a very reasonable guess. Mm-hmm. But I had heard that it's only a couple of days for nicotine to get out of your system, to actually break the addiction.
Mm.
But after that, post whatever 3, 5 days, whatever number of days it is, it's all it feels so good after I have a meal. It feels so good after, you know, to just have that minute to step out of the office and clear your head a little bit, get away from the boss.
Utopia.
I'll
never understand that.
But
so many people claim the same thing, so I imagine it's true. Obviously, that's why it's so addictive.
It's very hard. I miss it every day. I'm not going to lie and say,
I miss it every day. Listen to yourself, you junkie.
I miss my friend. I miss my friend. I used to call them smoky treats.
Smoky treats.
Yes.
Oh, my God. How could you equate treat with that? That's unbelievable.
I do miss it.
Well, in this day and age, what was the impetus, Liz, to quit smoking?
I had to just do it. I always wanted to
No
quit.
Pressure?
I know it's
just
not.
Just self-pressure?
I just, you know what?
Self-imposed?
I decided I was going to do it. And I went cold turkey.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
did you plan that? Cold turkey or
it
just kind of happened? You woke up and said that's enough.
You know what? You have to. It takes a lot of self-control. I weaned off slowly. I reduced the number of cigarettes day to day to day. And then until I was down to zero on my target date, which was January 5th.
Well, good for you. I wish you all the best. If anybody can do it, you can do it, my friend.
And now I don't feel like I, you know, you always felt self-conscious. Like every, like as soon as you walk into the room, you're like, wow, a smoker just came in.
Well, you know what? Some smokers have great decorum about smoking rights and do's and don'ts. You know, they either, you know, very respectful of how they blow it and smoke outside, or, you know, how the smoke wafts, or how comfortable or not they reek of smell. Well, smoke, you don't. You never did.
Well, in New York City, no one, I mean, now you can't smoke anywhere. Hmm. I mean, pedestrian plazas nowhere. I mean, I'm surprised you can even smoke in your home at this stage. But I always used to smoke outside. I always, you know, tried to, you know, use exhaust fans because I hated, if I could smell it on other people, I knew people could smell it on me.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I quit. I don't have to worry about it.
It's discipline, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And discipline, what about these?
As soon as we're done with the show, we're going to go outside and have a
No, 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 no. What about these Olympians? Aren't they amazing? Let's see another 720. What?
I feel so insignificant when I watch them on TV.
It's phenomenal. It's pretty. What's your favorite sport to watch?
In the winter or the summer? In the winter?
Well, we're in winter, and it's on right now.
I think we talked about it. At one point, we were talking about some of the sports. I get really nervous during skiing.
Ice skating is my thing because I'm like, I know they're going to fall, and I'm going to wish that they don't fall, and that's probably going to make them fall even more often.
But you know what, though? If an ice skater falls,
they're done. They're toast.
Yeah, but their butt's going to get wet. A skier, I'm afraid they're going to break their leg.
Oh, so you're thinking life and limb. I'm thinking points.
I don't want to see people get hurt. It really upsets me.
I love the long jump because these skiers just look like they're indomitable and they have wings where you just can't see. They're transparent.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
If I could do anything, I would think it would be that. I'd want you to do that.
If
I could do anything, I mean, a discipline. I mean, it's just amazing how some of them are kids and some of them are actually, you know, in their mid 20s and upper 20s, but good for them. It's just a great depiction of overcoming adversity, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, dedication, years and years of practice, and missing out on events, parties, trips, et cetera. And
training for so long for something that comes only once arduous. Every 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I find very, very exhilarating are the Paralympics. And a lot of people don't even know what the Paralympics are. Those are the Olympics, or Paralympics are the games after the Olympics. And this year it's March 11th through the 17th, I believe. And they're phenomenal. I mean, you just see things and acts of courage and athleticism that in my wildest dream I never thought would have been true. I used to work for a company called We Media. The television network. It was WE. It was the first magazine for people and family and friends with disabilities. It was cutting edge about 1997. Then they developed a website right before the .com and the bubble burst and all that stuff. It was an amazing company. And that gave me a privileged opportunity to go around the country and interview all these athletes, eventually went to Sydney in 2000. And I'd spent so much time with them. I mean, I would be on a dance floor at some events with quadriplegics, dual amputees, missing one arm, a limb, you name it. And they would tip over in the wheelchairs. And the first time I'm like, oh, my God, this is terrible. This, you know, everyone stop and laugh. No, just pick me up. Just pick me up or carry me here. Mark, can you put me into the bar? I mean, we would have a hell of a good time. And they had great stories. And they were just like every other athlete. They knew they had to train and work extra hard.
Well, I think people don't realize that in the Paralympics, these athletes have to qualify. Mm-hmm. So they already have to come with an enormous set of skills.
Oh, absolutely.
And they have to really train for this.
And just think about, I was thinking about the Paralympics, and I'm like, well, the Blade Runner won't be there this year.
I don't think so.
He's behind bars.
You know, Valentine's Day, it's going to be 1 year.
That's right, 1 year.
Isn't that sad?
That's a shame.
Day.
She was beautiful, the model. I forget her name.
Reva Steenkamp.
Steenkamp?
Steenkamp.
Czech? She Czech?
South African.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's all coming back to me now. That's a shame. And he ran with a cheetah feet. And I remember when the cheetah feet, that's the prosthetics that actually look like they're carbon fiber and they almost look like a kind of a C. And you should hear that noise. Have you ever been to a meet, track meet, and hear the cheetah feet go buzzing by?
I haven't.
It's phenomenal. It's music to my ears. You hear just... so unlike the sound of a sneaker, and yet you're just amazed because here are these, you know, graceful human beings just doing what they love, just like a gazelle. flying down that track.
Well, it's amazing how they get how that would get some traction on the ground.
Well, there is a surface to it, and some of them wear sneakers,
wow.
but a lot of them don't because you know it's there's such a niche and niche is not the right word subtlety to the fitting of the boot and the cheetah leg and everything that it's the nuances are pretty vast. But the courage these athletes have is amazing. And what is just disappointing to me and what I learned a great deal about back in 97 and leading up to the Sydney Olympics is that, you know, they were so bummed out. All the athletes were bummed out and so happy, ecstatic to be there and to be going to the Olympics after training for years and or their second or third time going back there as a Paralympian. But the fact that, you know, they're in the shadows of the Olympics. There's no television broadcast. So if there is, it's in the middle of the night. Highlight reel, maybe. You know, online, there's, you know, a website just for the Paralympics, which is great. There's going to be a lot of footage this year. But, you know, it would be nice, my perspective, I guess, because, you know, I have a disability, because I don't.
I am disabled.
You do?
I do.
I have limitations, but I don't, I guess the word disability limitations, they're synonymous to me. So, yeah, I have a disability. I think sometimes I have limitations, and I'll probably have more as a show, I mean, as my life goes on. But, you know, it's just a shame because these guys, they're just so amazing to watch. And I just think the networks, if they just gave it a shot, maybe even if they just did like a promo reel of, you know, the last Winter Olympics to tease it during the Olympics to show people, okay, all right, this is what's happening post-Olympics. Stay tuned for the Paralympics. And we're going to have some coverage. Maybe they even put it on their digital HD channel. That's what I'm imploring networks to do, man. Come on, do the right thing. What do you think, Liz?
Well, if they're listening, NBC.
It's just it's an amazing thing. I mean, you ever seen a Special Olympics event?
Well, Special Olympics is different from the Paralympics.
Totally different ball game.
But
the feeling that you get.
The
euphoria.
I did see something, and this was years ago, and I don't think it was the actual Special Olympics. I think it was one of the regional competitions. I had seen some footage, and remember just thinking to myself that, you know, it's exceptional. I have absolutely no excuse for being as unathletic as I am.
Or to complain about your life.
Absolutely.
You know, that's
absolutely.
What it is. You know what kind of got me, and we're going to move on after this, is that the other day I was watching the Olympics, and there was a commercial, I forget whether it was a 15-second little quick spot, and Coke said, proud sponsor of Special Olympics. Now, this could go one of two ways. They could just obviously be touting the fact that they promote and sponsor and support Special Olympics. Or to me, I kind of read it in another way, form, that a lot of people don't know the difference between Special Olympics and Paralympics. So they may feel like, oh, wow, that's great. They're actually supporting the Paralympians.
Well, the names are very deceiving.
They are.
And I think the fact that one is able to be Paralympics, one is Special Olympics, the way that you can remember Paralympics is that para means alongside. The Paralympics was that name was supposed to signify mm-hmm. that it
coincide.
Runs
mm-hmm.
parallel to the Olympic Games. Where Special Olympics, if I'm not mistaken, I think they actually say that they support athletes who are intellectually challenged.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yep, and physically.
Right.
Because some,
but
it's
I think
very common for both.
Yeah, but I think there has to be an intellectual disability.
Yes,
and there can
correct.
Be... Okay. Whew.
You got it.
I'm not as dumb as I look.
Oh, far from. So, you know, I'm glad you're listening today. So glad you're listening to the Maiden Voyage of Insight here with Mark Farrow and Liz Malone. And I figured there should be some additional information they should learn about me. So I put together some not so many important things you should know about me. I'm dedicated to helping people overcome adversity, which you learned. I don't twerk in public. Aren't you happy about that, Liz?
That is debatable.
I've come close to death under the influence several times, which one of them you heard about riding on top of an elevator. OCD, yeah, runs rampant in my family, and I have a tad of it. Do you, Liz?
It's hard to say. I always just thought maybe I was a little germaphobe, but I think everyone in New York is a
germaphobe. Yeah, exactly, and I think he should be to a certain degree. Not the Matt Lauer degree, right?
No.
Well, I guess I'm not too bad because I don't freak out with this pop filter. Pop filter is what you see on microphones that are usually different colors, and they prevent you from popping or peas. And anyway, it doesn't freak me out too much. You know what? It's weird. You know, with my visual disability, I'm not sure. Do you notice other aspects of your anatomy? Oh, okay, let me recouch this. Anyway, I have cat-like reflexes. Like the other day I dropped my cell phone, and before it hit the ground, I could bend down and scoop it up. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know if it's whether my eyes have a deficit.
That was divine intervention.
You're right.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Thank God I had spent another $500 on this blessed phone. My blood type, universal donor. O negative, baby. Can I ever help you out in a crisis, Liz?
Like I said, I think I'm putting you in speed dial on my phone in case of emergency.
That'd be a good thing. I've actually managed to coax a beautiful woman to marry me, number one, and to allow me and to trust me to be a good father not only once, but twice. Can you believe that?
You're a very lucky man.
And another thing that you should know about me that I have not professed to my wife is that when she watches these terrible, horrific reality shows that I always bust her chops for, that I secretly like watching them as well. And Real Housewives is one of them. I couldn't tell you what state or what city, whatever, but I do kind of like enjoying them.
You kind of like them?
Yeah, exactly.
You like them a lot.
Yeah. And finally, I auditioned for the lead role that Leonardo DiCaprio got in Wolf of Wall Street. But you know what? With my hectic schedule at PRN.FM and my touring with all my speaking at MarkFarrowMotivation.com, I had to say, you know what? Just give it to Leonardo.
That was so big of you.
Yeah, it was, right? Hey,
because you know what? Leo really needs the work.
He does.
He needs the money, too.
Special thanks to Jason Taubenfeld, Melissa at the controls. Hey, Melissa, thank you so much. The Gary Noel Show is next. You can always check him out weekdays right here, 12 to 1 o'clock on PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. That is the voice of
Liz Malone. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Yeah, happy Valentine's Day. Do the right thing, whatever that means. We'll catch you next week and every Thursday right here on PRN.FM, 11 a.m. to noon. And remember, your difference makes you stronger. Have a great day.